Falls Badlands. The story so far. Nana doesn't trust Galen, because no matter what he may have been in his past, there may be too little of the brother she once knew left inside him. She knows he's headed across the country to the land where the passengers of the Majestic lost their lives nearly a century and a half ago. And she also understands that Galen doesn't know anything about the town of Shadow Falls. So she tells him, and such begins the tale of what happened to Miles Lawton and his sister, and the French settlers who found them wandering in the woods. Chapter 20. Miles stood at the edge of the settlement for hours, staring into the woods, until his eyes went vacant and glassy. What he told nobody was that he was listening as the woods talked to him, and not a single person questioned the strangish behavior. Miles had done the same thing nearly every day for 7 years, ever since he arrived here with Allison. Nearly everyone paid no mind to Miles because of the circumstances which had brought him here, the brutal death of his family, and the 4 dozen members of their traveling party. Nonetheless, it didn't prevent most others in the settlement to consider Miles to be a bit strange. When called upon, Miles was a hard worker, often toiling in the vegetable fields for hours without a single complaint. But it was when they were in his company that many spoke in hushed voices that there was something about him that essentially gave them the creeps. One man remarked to his wife that Miles had cried once for his slain parents the day he arrived, but never did again afterwards. In fact, Miles had shunned closeness with anyone at the settlement, including Father Henri, who made every attempt to be a surrogate father to the boy. Miles, however, chose to be distant, even refusing to learn the native language of his hosts. In this way, he ensured that the only ones there who could communicate with him were Father Henri and his now nearly 8-year-old sister, Allison. And now that Miles had reached the age of 17, he had grown into a strapping young man, and when he chose to go off into the woods for days by himself, nobody stopped him. On these occasions, Father Henri would sit at night sipping wine with a watchful eye to the woods for Miles' return. Though he was unsure what the boy was doing, he was concerned. He had imagined on several occasions that Miles had been journeying back through the woods to the scene of the massacre. And though he himself had not ever gone, it was the day after Miles arrived that a small party of the men from the settlement made the trek to the spot that Miles described in an attempt to find any other survivors. What they had found were bodies torn to bits, and a field full of 4-legged and winged scavengers, eager to fill their bellies with the flesh of the dead. The clouds of blowflies that had accumulated and the decay of the corpses had made it difficult in some cases to tell man from woman. As they went from wagon to wagon, the results were the same, appearing just as Miles had described. They had even found the single victim who had died not by animal attack, but by his own hand. Maggots crawled from the self-inflicted head wound and wriggled through the empty eye sockets in his skull. Between them, the men could not decide if this one man had been lucky to take his own life or a coward for not trying to save the others. Later, they returned to the settlement and reported their findings to Father Henri. The priest asked the 3 men to never speak of what they had seen, certainly not to Miles. They all agreed it best be left to fade into memory. But fade it did not, Father Henri feared. The strange boy he had partially raised was returning time and time again to somehow commune with the spirits that the priest suspected haunted the boy to this day. And even if he had known he had been partially right, Father Henri still would not have been able to do anything to stop what was about to happen. Once again, Miles stepped through the thicket and walked across the overgrown grass to the remains of his parents' wagon. The seasons had ravaged it, until all that remained was a rusted and rotted hulk sitting in the tall weeds. There was no illusion in Miles' mind. He looked out at the other skeletal remains of the other wagons in the Majestic's party, and did not see the vibrant faces that rode them when they were almost new. He saw the wrecks for what they were, splintered remnants of the past that would continue to fade with time until they were nothing but dust. There was no nostalgia for this place, none whatsoever, for it was not the memories that brought Miles here, but the blood in the ground which had given it power. The bones of the dead had long since been dragged away, the flesh consumed, but the blood of the innocent that had been spilled here in sacrifice acted like a magnet to Miles' soul. And over the years, as he grew older, that pull to this land grew stronger until it became the ever-consuming force of his life. The face he wore around Father Henri and the others was a mask. They had proven very useful during a period of time when he had needed the food and shelter they could provide, but that time was soon coming to an end. He had chosen early on to not develop close relationships with those who he was certain would not live long enough to warrant the necessity. And as dusk began to set, he stood in the field and could only imagine the thousands of lives before his families that had been taken here, going back hundreds of years, people who had been held down onto the ground while their still beating hearts were carved out of their chests by high priests wielding razor-sharp obsidian knives. Those who had been buried and burned alive, including children. The young were especially valued as sacrifices, because they were thought to be pure and unspoiled, and it was thought the more that they cried and wailed during their slow, torturous death, the better the omen. From his pocket, Miles took his father's kerchief, now slightly yellowed and wrinkled from age. What he had kept inside, however, seemed as pristine as the day he'd obtained it. Gently, he picked up the single eye of his father, the one he had kept. He had given the second one to Allison, who had shunned it for reasons Miles still did not understand. He gazed into the eye, willing his mind to enter the same visual pathways enchanted in the orb, to see that which his father had seen during the years preceding the journey to the new world. The same visions, Miles was convinced, contained the keys to unlock not only his destiny, but that of every man, woman, and child in the mortal world. But as hard as he tried, he could not bring forth the visions from the long-dead eye, the images his father had seen, that he knew his sister Allison had seen as well, were eluding him now, as they had his entire life. Frustrated, Miles wrapped his fingers around the eye and took a deep breath. Again, he pulled every ounce of inner strength from within his body until his arms shook and his legs caved under him. Miles fell, the eye slipping from his hands onto the ground, just inches away from where he lay, breathing heavily, his heart pounding with furious intensity inside his chest. And it was there that he sobbed in the grass. The draw of this land was so great, like a giant magnet pulling upon every cell inside his body. But the one thing that he felt lay behind Destiny's door continued to elude him. Inside his father's eye was the portent of what was to come, the very thing he sacrificed his family and the families of those he brought with him on the Majestic. With the knife he had used all those years ago to remove those eyes from his dead father's skull, the same knife that his father had used on him to slit the palm of his hand, Miles drew a pentagram in the dirt and placed himself inside. Again, he focused his mind on the orb until the ache in his brain pounded so hard, it forced him to his knees. There he stayed, with his head hung low. There had never been a moment in Miles's life quite like this, one where the feeling of utter failure washed over him with such totality.
"I failed you,"
he spoke out loud. Cupped in his hands, the eye rolled to its side, so that only the veiny backside pointed toward Miles.
"Why do you cry?"
the voice asked, startling Miles. He looked up. Silhouetted against the setting sun was the figure of what appeared to be a man coming toward him. In the woods, Allison carried a basket of freshly washed laundry as she walked the path back from the creek toward the settlement. Behind her rose the tuneful voice of Odile, the French girl who had found both her and Miles 7 years ago in the woods. Over the years, Allison and Odile had become close friends. It was Odile who had taught Allison her native language, though Miles did his best to make sure she learned her fair share of English. And it was Allison whom Odile had grown to confide in, and vice versa. From Odile's mouth came an old folk song, one about the plight of a washerwoman who ran off with a man who didn't love her. And Allison began to laugh, but no sooner did she start than her chuckle caught in her throat.
"Miles is in danger. Go, now,"
a voice in her head told her. Before she could give it any thought, she let the basket of clean wash fall to the ground and was running into the woods.
"Allison!"
Odile called after her, a little bit confused and very much concerned. As the figure approached, Miles felt a sense of utter fear in the pit of his stomach, unlike anything else he'd felt since that night his father dragged him away from the camp and into the woods. The night of his transcendence, he often thought of it in his mind. He had never forgotten the feeling of being trapped inside the pentagram while his father chanted. But now, he again faced the unknown. In the last 7 years, the voices, the ones that spoke to him from the woods, always seemed to guide him, to assure him that he would soon take his place in the changing of the world. And as he remained frozen on his knees, those very same voices seemed to all at once abandon him, as did his breath, for the air around him suddenly turned dry and hot, pushing toward him as if a furnace door had just been opened in his face. Each attempt Miles made to inhale seemed to burn his throat and nostrils, and it became quickly apparent that with each step the darkened figure took, the heated air Miles was breathing was radiating from the dark figure's body. Miles tried to get up, but his legs felt weak and useless, and suddenly his hands began to shake as the dark figure stood over him, blocking out all the light from the sky.
"Do you kneel before me out of respect, or do you kneel out of fear?"
the figure spoke as it reached down for Miles. Allison ran as hard as she could until it felt as if her heart would explode. The path toward the field she had left behind as a baby seemed to open up for her, guiding her way. Though she had only ventured back here once in the intervening years, it was as if something were pulling her to her brother's side. And as she broke through the woods into the clearing, she could see the overgrown patches of weeds that now mostly hid the skeletal remains of the rotting wooden wagons that had been long left behind. But as her eyes darted back and forth, Miles was nowhere to be seen. But she could sense him. He was here. She pushed through the weeds, feeling his presence stronger and stronger, until she found him laying bleeding and badly hurt on the ground.
Miles,
she cried out as she went to him, pulling him to her chest to comfort him.
Who did this?
It was hard for Miles to answer, for at first he could not speak. And when he finally did, what came out of his mouth was a warning.
He's here,
Miles revealed.
The wolf.
And so goes chapter 20 of Shadow Falls Badlands. It seems that the wolf has arrived, but what does that mean for the descendants of William Lawton? And what exactly did happen to Miles before Allison came to his aid? As always, I want to hear your questions and comments. Send them to me at shadowfalls@podshowla.com. And of course, a big, big thanks to Monk for the Shadow Falls Part 3 theme song, I Am Molly's Theme, acoustic version, which you can find at music.podshow.com. Hey, do you have some friends who would like Shadow Falls Badlands, or even Shadow Falls Season 1? Burn them a CD with the first few episodes, or send them to shadowfalls.podshow.com. I don't know about you, but I smell confrontation coming in the coming chapters. So until next time, this is Mark Yoshimoto Nemkov, fading to black.
I just begun. I was dead wrong. The rusted gate that swings both ways never asked my name. Soft, my words are floating off.